Stay tuned, because at 11, host Jean Bradley will speak with Doris Cairns Goodwin about her book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. All that coming up on your community radio station, KBOO. Thanks for tuning in today. Here comes Between the Covers.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Flanagan, whose latest novel is The Narrow Road to the Deep North, just recently shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Earlier novels include Gould's Book of Fish, The Unknown Terrorist, Wanting. There's a collection of short stories. This latest book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, concerns the railway being built between Burma and Thailand by the Japanese during World War II, and the main character is named Dargo Evans. I understand that your father, Archie, died at the age of 98 recently. He was in those camps and forms the rationale for writing this tale. I understand you have been working on it for something like 12 years, and it's the book you always wanted to write?
Yeah, that's all true, Richard. The title's actually taken from possibly the most famous book in Japanese literature, a haibun, or travel journal of prose and haiku, written by the great haiku master Basho in the late 17th century. And I guess if Basho's poetry and The Narrow Road to the Deep North represent one of the high points of Japanese culture, the experience of my father and his mates building what in Australia is known as the Death Railway is one of its low points. It was one of the great, not the greatest, but it is one of the great crimes against humanity that occurred during World War II. The Japanese decided to push this railway through the jungle of what was then called Siam and Burma, and is today Thailand, some 428 kilometres long, and they used a quarter of a million slave labourers to build it. Those people had no machinery, only hand tools, and somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 of them died in the 8 or 9 months in which the railway was built. Most of them were Asian slave labourers. A proportion of them, a much smaller proportion of them, were Allied prisoners of war, and my father was one of those. And he was a survivor of that, of the hell ships that then took the survivors to Japan, but working as a slave labourer in a coal mine under the inland sea south of Hiroshima at war's end. Finally, there were two great facts in my life. I was a writer, but I'd also grown up with this man of often strange anxieties, but the sort of great compassion and pity and also humour. I understood at a certain point I was a child of that death railway. The more I tried not to write about it, the more it consumed me. And at some point, I knew I had to write the book if I was going to be able to write anything else.
You say that you tried not to write the book, but on some level you knew you'd eventually have to tackle it?
I guess that's right. I mean, writers are largely autistic to their own works. You know, they don't really understand what it is they do or what they achieve. Occasionally they have the arrogance of confusing their initial ambitions and aspirations with their achievement. But if they've actually achieved anything worth reading, it is because they've written something that long ago escaped their intentions. Nothing is really as secondary to a writer's achievements as their original intentions.
When you're working on other books that had to do with the war, there was an earlier novel that had to do with World War II. It must have been in your mind. Was it just that when he got old, you realized he's going to be gone soon?
I wrote this as 5 separate novels. That's what took me 12 years. I wrote it as a novel of linked haiku. I wrote it as a haibun, that travel journal, nature journal I was talking about earlier. I wrote it as a sort of Odyssean epic, which is narrated in the first person plural by this nameless group of POWs. I wrote it as a family saga, and each of these novels were failures, and so I wiped them from the hard drive and I burnt the manuscripts, and I started again. And in between these failures, I wrote other novels, but always I was trying to find the form. And you're right, I mean, my father, I realised, was growing old and frail, and there is no good reason for this. it is not a logical thing, but it seemed important that I finish it before he died, because, again, illogically, I felt if I didn't, I never would, and if I didn't, something would have stopped in me also. So I returned to the task, and I came to think it had to be a love story, and the image at the centre of it really is a story my parents were fond of, which was a true story of a Latvian man who lived in the little town where I was born, Longford in Tasmania. And this Latvian man had survived those sort of great movements for peoples that had afflicted the bloodlands of Eastern Europe. And at the war's end, he managed to make it back to his village to find the village razed to the ground and his wife was dead. He refused to believe this, and he spent 2 years searching the wastes of Eastern Europe for his wife, and in the end he had to accept that it was true, what he'd been told, that she was dead. He immigrated to Australia, ended up in this little town of Longford where I was born, met an Australian woman, married her and had children. In 1957 he went to Sydney, and he was walking down a crowded street when he saw walking towards him his Latvian wife with a child on either hand. And at that point he had to decide whether he would acknowledge her or whether he would walk on. And this story, I always thought, was the most beautiful story about love, about its pain, how it involves terrible choices, how love can be a hell also. So I started again with this image at its centre, and I created a lead character. It's really an ensemble novel, but there is a central character, and he's utterly unlike my father. He's the character you talked about at the beginning, Dorrigo Evans. He's a womanising surgeon who discovers, to his shame and somewhat to his horror, that he's acclaimed as a war hero after the war's end. But for me to write the novel about this incommunicable experience, I had to be free from my father's own story. And that's why I did it.
Richard Flanagan, one of the things that occurred to me in the construction of the book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which goes back and forth between the past, when he was growing up at the beginning, and then his affair with Amy, which is the analog to this love story you're talking, back to when he's very old, and then back in between that, telling the story of the camps. It almost reminded me a little bit of the structure of Slaughterhouse 5.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, well, I mean, I love Slaughterhouse 5. But I suspect when people talk to writers, they're always interested in their literary influences. But your true literary influences are often the kitchen or the pub or the street, you know, as much as any novel. And I suspected I grew up in a world which was without ideology, it was without aesthetics, it was, you know, this marginal, an island at the end of the world. Tasmania's about the size of Sri Lanka or Ireland. It's some hundreds of kilometres south of Australia. And we were marginal to Australia, which was at the time utterly marginal to the world. What people had were stories, and the stories were circular. They weren't linear. I think politics tends to be linear, ideology and so on tends to be linear. But there was an idea of stories having this sort of eternal return in them. And I think that related to the sense of time that was very strong there. There's that beautiful poem by Borges, Time is a river that sweeps me along, but I am that river. Time is a fire that burns me, but I am that fire. Time is a tiger that consumes me, but I am that tiger. And it is that sense of time as being something that is the very nub of what you are, the essence of what you are, not something that you move along and leave behind. It was that sense that I grew up with. And so the novel structure really reflects the way life was understood in the world I grew up in. And perhaps what I loved about books like Slaughterhouse 5 was that they thought about life more in that sort of way.
We don't hear anything about Tasmania. It is, for, you know, all intents and purposes, kind of stuck in the side off at the end of the world. For us, it's an island that was originally a prison.
It's got an Aboriginal history that's 40 to 50,000 years old. There was human civilization there probably 20,000 years before there was human civilization here in North America. It's modern history, that is to say, it's post-invasion history, had for a quarter of it Tasmania being the gulag of the British Empire that was known as Van Diemen's Land. And really most people on the island are the issue of either convicts who were sent there during that time or the remnants of the Aboriginal people who survived the great genocidal Black War. So it is an unusual place with an unusual past, but there's good reasons why people haven't heard anything about it. It's only 500,000 people. It is of no consequence. I mean, the thing about this nation is that everyone who grows up here knows that what this nation does matters. I grew up in a society that knew it would never matter. That's a very different thing. I also grew up, I guess, in a world which in consequence it had that circuit sense of time. It also had a sense of the natural world and of natural things being more powerful. The measure of most things in this society are things that are man-made. That's where glory and wonder tends to be found again and again. The measure of things in my society was all that wasn't man-made, this extraordinary natural world. So it was a very different experience, and it influenced my writing a lot.
And it clearly influenced how you look at the events that happened in Burma and Siam in the 40s, where suddenly your father was thrust into the world, and yet at the same time, the entire genocide that you speak of in the book, in The Narrow Road to the Deep North, has mostly been forgotten. And if it's remembered, it's remembered as a 1957 movie called Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah, which is a David Lean movie. It's a good movie. It just doesn't happen to relate at all to the reality of what happened there. Bears no resemblance, in fact, to what happened there. Does that matter? Look, we've talked a whole lot about the motley with which this novel's covered, the characters, the setting, my background. That's actually, in the end, I think, unimportant about a novel. I think a novelist journeys into their own soul to discover there the strange, incommunicable things they share with others. We're expected, and rightly so, to get pass through our lives pretending we're one pebble on a beach, and we try to keep the characteristic shape that we think we are as that pebble. We love reading because what we realise in that beautiful act of communion when you love a book is that we're not that pebble. You know, we are the universe, and contained within us are all possibilities of good, evil, love, hate, and so on. And the novelist, the writer, should go into their soul daily to discover that universe. That what results in the, you know, with the low craft and dirty cunning of their trade with character and story is so that you can communicate the incommunicable to your reader. But ultimately, it's not what the novel is about. The novel's actually, finally, I think, a quite abstract medium.
You're listening to an interview with Richard Flanagan, whose latest novel is The Narrow Road to the Deep North. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Towards the beginning of the book, we see the monsters, the Japanese monsters, and then one of them, we get into his head, Nakamura, and suddenly we see he's operating on a completely different plane, and later we learn that the guard, who is the Korean guard, is even worse, is operating on a completely different plane too, which meant for you, you had to get into the soul of not only the good people, but the bad people as well.
The disturbing truth is I always felt closer to the monsters. And, you know, it's not for me to judge my own work, that's for readers, but I feel they are the most fully realised human beings in the novel. And perhaps that's because murder, horror, wickedness, these things lie deeply buried within our breast as love, kindness, goodness, perhaps even more so. They are in every human breast. And the thing is, they're often much more closely entwined than we would care to admit. And the history of the last century is the history of so much evil being done by people who believe that for them to demonstrate their goodness, for them to discover that union of action and the best in their soul, commit atrocities of the greatest horror. The Japanese, to my mind, weren't that much different than the English colonists I described in my previous novel, Wanting, in the way they treated the Aborigines in Van Diemen's Land. I went to Japan. I don't really research my novels. I remember reading a thing Borges said, you know, the Quran's an Arabic book because there's not a camel in it. You can go out into the desert and spend too long trying to lasso camels and bring back to put in your novel when it actually takes away from it. So I don't research much, but near the end I felt this need to go to Japan, and the novel's in rough final form, and I went there and I tracked down several guards who'd worked on the Death Railway, including one who was the Ivan the Terrible of my father's camp, a man known to the Australian POWs as the Lizard. And the Lizard had been sentenced to death for war crimes at the end of World War II, had his sentence commuted to life imprisonment, and then was finally released in a general amnesty. He was the only man I ever heard my father talk of with, and my father was a very gentle man, but he did speak of the Lizard with violent intent. The man I met in this taxi office in outer suburban Tokyo was a gentle, gracious and generous old man. And we talked for about an hour and a half. I didn't go there in a spirit of accusation or prosecution. I went there to just try and uncover the detail of his life.
When you first saw him, I mean, what ran through your mind? Anything, or you just tried to stay blank?
I really tried to stay blank, but I tried to record. I didn't have a recorder. I just tried to see what was there, not what I brought into that, you know, not what I was walking into that taxi office with. And what I saw was this man at pains to be courteous, seeking to answer my questions, who was gracious. And I tried to listen to his answers to what he was saying to me. After about an hour and a half, I asked him if he would slap me, because slapping, which was known as binta, was the immediate and most frequent and violently given form of corporal punishment in the camps. And they would just beat men with these slaps senseless. He rightly thought it was a bizarre request, but finally agreed, and we stood up. And on the third slap, the whole room started to toss up and down like a dinghy in a wild sea, and a 7.3 Richter scale earthquake had in fact hit Tokyo, which is one of the most bizarre sort of things I've had. And the room was rolling. That's the only way to describe it. Things are falling off the wall. And I was too ignorant to know what a dangerous thing this was, as I'd never been in an earthquake before. The Lizard was very frightened, and I looked at this frightened old man, and I knew wherever evil was, it wasn't in that room with us. So I always think at the end of the day, a writer's job is just to make it up. I learnt nothing. I went back to Australia and went back to making the book up, trying to divine the undivinable as best I could each morning at that table.
What was the slap like? I mean, how painful was it?
I don't know why I asked him to do it. It's just one of those things.
I can understand why you'd want him to do it.
What do you think?
Well, it kind of puts you there in a way. It makes you feel, I guess, on some level, it explains to you in a way that words can't what at least one small piece of what went on, at least a tiny little piece, a smidgen, a pebble, if you want to call it that.
And yeah, I think that's true. I think also, I said I didn't want to go there I wanted to know. I did want to know, as you've said. And what I felt as I waited for the first blow, and he could slap. He'd clearly done a lot of it. He cupped his hand a certain way. He held his body, twisted his body slightly. I mean, he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And when he'd been talking, he'd been very good about all the detail of his early life. He was a Korean. You know, he'd been so terribly treated by the Japanese. He was virtually press ganged into being a guard. But when we got to the camps, his grasp of detail began to elude him, and he claimed he'd never been violent. And I knew that was a lie, and I didn't want to accuse him, but I wanted him to know, I knew, that it was a lie. When I stood up and I was waiting for the blow, I felt this most terrible vertigo, this immense sadness at what human beings do to one another, and also a fear, because I was waiting for a blow. When the blow, he was an old man, it wasn't that terrible. I just remember how dry and sort of papery, leathery the skin of his fingers were when he hit me.
It almost feels, though, that if you commit great evil and want to live with yourself, wouldn't there be a tendency to try to block it out, to rationalize, to try to make yourself the hero of the book when you know you're the villain?
I think that's true, and I think many people going to their death, there's a character who does manage that in the book, a Japanese character, and he goes to his death believing he's a good man. There are characters who are good men who go to their death thinking they're wicked men. There's nothing we're not capable of, but it doesn't get us further to thinking about what's the nature of evil. I mean, we're confronted at this moment with this question in a profound political sense with the rise of ISIS in the Middle East. So these aren't really abstract questions, that they're not. They don't belong in the realm of the theologian or the philosopher alone, far from it. These are these forces, these strange, irrational, abstract forces exist, and they shape all our destinies. But I think what a novel can offer is the sense of how deeply human it is, and the understanding that the face of evil can also be our own face.
Richard Flanagan, as I got into the head of Nakamura, the Japanese, the Korean guard, and as you see the world from their perspective, and in the case of the Korean guard in your novel, he's doing what he's told, and if he doesn't do what he's told, he's dead. He has no choice. He is, in some sense, as much a prisoner as the prisoners if he wants to survive, and he has to make a choice between survival and what he has to do. And on some level, it makes the real war criminals the people who don't have to be in the jungle and don't have to be in the war itself.
I think that's true. I think real evil doesn't begin with the first beating or beheading on the death railway. It doesn't begin with the first beheading in the deserts of northern Iraq. It begins when ideas are set loose in society by public figures, by intellectuals, by politicians, by spiritual leaders, that some people are less than people. And once these ideas gain hold, they poison the soul of society, and then great evil becomes responsible. And at the end of that, you end up with ordinary people who are neither good nor bad, who have to live with the consequences of that evil because they are the instruments of it. I mean, I thought much about this, and in the end I realised I understood nothing. But bar two things. One is that it matters enormously in every society to never ever allow anyone in public life or private life to say some people are less than people, and therefore it's okay to do terrible things to them. It is never okay. It leads to horror. The other thing I believe is that, or I came to believe, is that one shouldn't take their compass too much from that darkness. In writing this book, I wanted it to be a love story, because with love we discover eternity in a moment that dies immediately after. That's why love stories always have to have death in them. That's why a war story and a love story go so well together, because war story is, in the end, a story about death. So war illuminates love, but love doesn't redeem war or horror. but it is the highest expression we have of human hope. And human hope is the one light we have to shine on that dark chaos at the centre of things. Nietzsche said that hope was the greatest of human evils because it prolongs suffering and torment. And there's truth in that. But once we lose hope, we die. And whether it is a torment or not, it is the essence of us, the nub of us, it is the engine of us. So if you are seeking to write a novel about these things, you cannot only enter the darkness. You have to allow for the possibility of dancing back out into the light. And it is love and hope, it is love as that expression of hope that allows for that. And I think the world does advance to a better place through everyday acts of kindness and goodness by people too easily dismissed as everyday. The dilemma in modern life is that we are so awash on all our screens everywhere with the images of horror that we choose too easily to take our compass from the despair rather than the hope and the kindness. And that hope and kindness, you can't make a politics out of it. You can't make an ideology out of it. But perhaps that's the strength of it and the beauty of it.
So, Richard Flanagan, now you've completed Narrow Road to the Deep North. It's been published. Have you started thinking about what your next project's going to be?
I have felt quite liberated since I finished it, and I've got a new novel which I've finished a second draft of and hope to have out next year, all going well. And I've got another novel which I've got about half done, which with a bit of fair sailing will be out the year after that.
And your essays, not long ago you wrote an essay which argued against the conformity of Australian life. You're continuing to dip into nonfiction as well.
I do, but the novel comes always before everything else. You know, whenever there's a question of what has to be written, it's the novel. That one on the conformity of Australian life. Australians, even more than Americans, think that they're the great individuals, but much more so than Americans. They are, in fact, the great conformists, and conformity is really the Australian disease. In consequence, it doesn't like people who go against the tribe. And that means it has a very ambivalent relationship with its artists, because if an artist is doing their job properly, they're brushing against the grain.
Richard Flanagan, given your history with the material in the book, how do you think having written this book changes you?
I think it corrodes me out. It has corroded me out. I think it's left me a little less. There's that great essay by Fitzgerald, The Crack-Up, about how you give the best of you in your stories, and slowly there's less and less of you. And in the end, that embittered, not very nice man sitting in the corner of the bar, that's the writer. If you succeed in writing a book that matters to readers, the chances are you've lost a little bit more of yourself in the making of it.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Flanagan, whose latest novel is The Narrow Road to the Deep North. I'm Richard Walensky on BookWaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. BookWaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, our community radio station here. And we're about to launch into the second feature on Between the Covers. Host Jean Bradley speaking with Doris Cairns Goodwin about her book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism.
Hello, this is Gene Bradley. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. Our guest today is writer and historian Doris Cairns Goodwin. She's joining us to talk about her new book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. The Bully Pulpit is now available in paperback, published by Simon Schuster. And welcome to KABU.
I am delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Now, among your many books, of course, you got lots of famous books. You got The Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II. That was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And you're going to be on featured in Ken Burns' upcoming PBS documentary on the Roosevelts.
That is correct. I'm so glad, actually, because the people that I've spent time with, including Teddy Roosevelt and then Franklin and Eleanor, you know, years of my life. And so to have that chance to work with Ken, who I've worked with before on baseball, on the same group of people, it has really been a grand experience.
And that's called The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. And that's great. Well, you spent 7 years working on this project. And you write that you set out with the intention of writing about Theodore Roosevelt and the Progressive Era, but it became something much more than that. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. I mean, I think I always start the subject, somebody that I want to live with, because I know it's going to take me a long period of time. And I've always been interested in Teddy Roosevelt from the time I taught a seminar on him way back when I was starting to teach at Harvard. But I knew there'd been some wonderful recent books on him, so I couldn't just do a biography. So it happened that I started early on reading a series of letters. I always love letters. Letters and diaries are my favorite source as an historian. They're so intimate. And I found a series of 400 letters between Teddy and Taft and realized they'd been friends from the time they were young and that they had really grown up together in many ways, and their families knew each other and their children, that Teddy had sponsored his going over to the governor generalship of the Philippines when he came back, brought him into his cabinet, was his closest advisor, it made him his successor in 1908, and then ended up running against him, his old friend, in 1912. So I just knew instinctively that that was a story that had drama and conflict and sadness and emotion that I wanted to tell. So Taft became a figure to study as equal to Teddy, which I never would have imagined at the beginning.